Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The Denisons, the Denisons, the busiest in the biz. You do know who it is, it's Dennis Quaid. That's him.
Hi, Dennis Quaid here, and today on the Denisons, I'm speaking with podcast pioneer and a true Renaissance man in his own right, Adam Carolla. Adam shares his rather unique story of how he discovered what it was he wanted to do in life, and how it brought him to where he is today. I hope you enjoy it. All right. Well, hello, everybody. Dennis Quaid is here, and so is Adam Carolla here on the Denisons. Adam Carolla is a true Renaissance man. That is for sure. The guy is not only a huge, well, he's a podcast pioneer, and has the record for the most downloaded podcast, 250,000 on his very first day that he had. He's also a skilled carpenter. He races cars, collects cars. You were a traffic school instructor, right?
I was.
I take it. To stand-up comedy, a boxer for many years. You boxed as a light heavyweight. Would I be right about that?
Yes. That would be correct.
You were a football player. You were all-city, all-college football player. You're a filmmaker. What is it that you haven't done? What is it that you're not interested in?
I'm trying to think. I guess I don't know what I'm not interested in, because as soon as I find out about something, then I'm interested in it. Off the top of my head, if you were to say, what is it that you've always kind of liked and known about but never really participated in, I would say it would be flying aircraft. I've always loved aircraft. I've always loved speed. I've always loved that kind of control, piloting. I know you have some history in that. And for me, the one thing that I've always kind of been interested in and I've never gotten near is that subject.
What is the reason about that fear of death?
There's an element of fear in there, but that's never really been a big factor for my endeavors in life. It's just... there's an element, I'll tell you, for me, I come from a very humble background, and it's, you know, I think people think that growing up without money just means you're growing up poor, but it's more than that. There's a psychological part of it, and certain things like getting a pilot's license or having your own aircraft, that's for other people. That's for other people. You know, I felt that way. I was essentially rich for 10 years before going to Maui, you know, because Maui, that's what other people do. You don't do that, you know? And it's like, why wouldn't you do it? Like, because that's for other people. It's that that mentality, you know?
Sounds like that comes from, like, growing up kind of middle class in North Hollywood.
Lower middle class, but just... the notion of going to Maui or getting your pilot's license or, you know, buying, you know, I don't use Grubhub. I can't have people bring food to my house. That's for other people. It feels weird.
In this day and age, I can't believe that. That's hard.
It's like if you want a pizza or you want tacos or whatever, then go order them and go get them. That's the way I feel about it.
You can see who puts their hands on them.
I don't even care about that. I really don't. I have no fear of it. It's just there's certain, it's an interesting thing because I will buy a $5 million car. I have done that. But if you order tacos, then you go to Chipotle and you pick them up. I have no idea how my wiring works. That's how it works.
I mean, I myself, when it comes to like flying, I was terrified to fly. But the thing that spurred me to do it was because I got the right stuff and I was playing an astronaut. And I felt like, as part of the research, I really needed to get over that and learn how to talk on that radio voice, you know.
Right.
They all have. And it was terrifying. I felt like I was going to fall out of the sky the first time I was there. But it was something I got over. Anytime I have a real fear of something, it's usually the thing that drives me to do it.
Yes. A lot of people could learn from that.
But you can't pull off on a cloud, and yet you race cars, right?
Yes.
Which is a lot more dangerous than flying, actually.
Sure. Maybe. I guess so. I guess it depends what kind of flying and what kind of racing. But yes, probably statistically racing is probably more dangerous.
You grew up there in North Hollywood. What is it that you wanted to be? Did you have any idea or inkling what it was that you were going to become?
You know, it was a little, the notion of becoming something was a little bit of a luxury. People were in my group, we were in sort of fight or flight mode all the time. So we were kind of thinking about getting a job. You know, we had the kind of thoughts I had when I was a senior in high school is, what kind of job could I get? How long, you know, can I live in the garage of my dad's house before my stepmom, Lynn, kicks me out? What could I do to kind of prove that I was alive? Maybe I could take a couple of classes at the junior college. If I could get a job, wouldn't it be good if I could get a job like at a supermarket? I hear they have unions. You could be in the cashier's union or the bag boy union or the stockers union. And I've heard about guys who got $11 an hour, but some of them who worked on Easter or Christmas got golden time. They got $22 an hour for stocking shelves on Easter. And, you know, on Christmas, you get 3 days paid vacation. Like, I had thoughts like that, like basic, super basic thoughts about jobs and, you know, time and a half on working Sundays.
Yeah.
I didn't have thoughts about about being an actor or being a comedian.
But you did go to community college for a couple of years. And was that just to mark time or when I get kicked out of the garage apartment?
I was a pretty good high school football player. I got recruited to play football at a couple of colleges that weren't big football powerhouses or anything. There were Cal Poly Pomona, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, Pacific, Marshall, which became better later on in football, and a bunch of little schools like Willamette and Lewis and Clark, weird little colleges, you know, to play football. And I didn't have grades, and I didn't take the SATs, and I didn't have anything. I was essentially illiterate. So the coach from L.A. Valley College, Chuck something, I can't remember his last name, but he sort of recruited me. He said, you know, come to Valley College, play here for a year or two, and then transfer into, you know, Cal Poly Pomona or San Luis Obispo or UC Davis was one of the schools. So, like, go to one of those schools. So I said, oh, okay. And I got to junior college to play football, essentially. And Chuck Ferrero, thank you, Gary, is the guy's name. And just quite frankly, the competition was too stiff. I just wasn't good enough. I was good enough to play a little bit and kind of, you know, be a second string guy for the first season and then start the next season. And I was just kind of looking at the tea leaves going, I don't think this football thing's going to work out. And I don't have any money and I need a job. So I just kind of...
Yeah, were you a lineman? What did you play?
I played outside linebacker in college, at Valley College. And then I just dropped out. And then I was just kind of living in a garage and the economy was junk. It was 1983 and I didn't have a job and there weren't any jobs. And I just found myself going from sort of construction site to construction site, trying to ask for work. It's like I knew a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy who built condominiums. And I just kind of show up going, hey, you need any labor? What can I do? And Mostly they weren't hiring. And then one day I just got a call from a guy who was working on a job, and he said they needed a guy to come out to Silver Lake and pull ivy off the side of a house they were building in Silver Lake. And I just came out there and pulled ivy off the side of the house all day. Yeah.
At my first job out of high school, I graduated like midterm because I went to summer school the year before. And my first job was construction myself. I was a laborer. Basically, I did a little bit of everything. I was an apprentice to a master carpenter named Big Rod. And we're doing joist work on these apartments. And I knew enough that was one of the big impetuses that propelled me to get into acting.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth, because I knew I didn't want to be out there every morning at 7 o'clock. And God bless the people who actually do that for a living. They're the real heroes of the world. It's tough work.
It's tough. It's tough work, regardless of who you are. The laborers, you know, you start with the toughest, worst, dirtiest jobs as a laborer because you have no skill. You work your way up to finish carpenter. It's not as tough a job. But it's really tough if you're a creative type. And I didn't know I was a creative type, but it's really tough to do repetitive labor all day with no stimulation at all. So I would dig ditches at the beginning, and I just dug ditches. I mean, that's what you do. We do 10 hours a day, and you dig ditches for 10 hours a day. That was it. If you were lucky, there was a radio on somewhere in the background playing some classic rock. But other than that, it's just you and, you know, Steely Dan and a shovel. And that was your life. And I was sort of going stir crazy because I was a creative, but I didn't know it. I just thought I was here to work.
What was it in you that made you know that you were a creative?
I found myself constantly sort of trying to make people laugh and saying little witticisms and repeating things and listening to Sunday night radio when Dr. Demento would come on in Los Angeles and, you know, a 19-year-old Weird Al would play funny songs with his accordion, you know. And I had this attraction to it, you know. I didn't, nobody fostered it around me. I didn't know what to do with it, but I felt like, you know, honestly, what I felt like is whenever somebody tells you there are, you know, a woman trapped inside a man's body, you know, you go, well, how did that? And they go, I don't know. Like, my dad was a steel worker. My mom was a nurse and nobody in my school. But I always felt weird. I always felt like there was somebody else trapped in me. But I didn't know what to do. And then at some point when I was 19, I put a dress on and I felt relief, you know. And I felt that way about having a sense of humor. I was like, I was working with all these blue collar dudes and kept wanting to do comedy, but everyone thought I was sort of weird. And eventually I just started thinking, there's something in me. I don't know what it is. It's making digging ditches all day uncomfortable. So I need to try to explore that in some way.
Is that when you got into the Groundlings? And
yeah, I said.
Did you try stand up first, like go into one of those, you know, open mic nights and then get into it? Or
I probably did an open mic or two. I, of course, was horrible at it, and it didn't feel that good to me. It didn't take. I of course had no idea what I was doing, so it probably wouldn't feel that good. But I talked to a friend. I had a friend, you know, where I grew up in North Hollywood. I had sort of the Valley guys who were just straight guys, you know, football players, construction worker guys, all the guys who went from playing football to a construction site with me. Those are sort of my regular blue collar friends. But there were a handful of creative types who lived up in Studio City, up in the hills. And these were Jewish families who sometimes worked in the industry. And I had a friend, a girlfriend of mine, whose parents both kind of worked in the industry. Like, one did music composition, the other was like a manager or something. And there was just like this nice Jewish family up in Studio City Hills. And so I knew I shouldn't ask my buddy Ray's mom, who was a cocktail waitress, about this, but my friend Danielle, I should ask her mom, Judy Chaikin. Like, she might know something about this stuff. So I just said to her, hey, I want to do comedy acting or I didn't even know improvisational acting, but I was like, what would you do? Where should I go? And she said, go to the Groundlings. And I had never heard of the Groundlings or anything. She said, yeah, they're down on Melrose. Go down there. I think she said, go down there like on a Saturday night, watch a show. And then if you like it, then you sign up for a class. I said, okay. So I went down there. I was probably 22 and drove my pickup truck down there and watched a show. And I was really impressed. And I had this kind of feeling of, I could never do that, but I'd like to try. And I just signed up for a class the next day.
Mm. It sounds like you were like casting around for encouragement about it. And you're looking for the right person to like mentor you or encouragement to get there a little bit.
Yeah, that was in short supply where I came from. So I had kind of, I guess there's kind of three groups when you're young. I guess there's three groups as I think about it. There's your immediate family, your dad and your mom and, you know, your group. You know, how do they, where are they on the encouragement scale? And my family's a zero in that department. They just, it wasn't like they liked, it wasn't like my dad said, you're going to be an orthodontist. You're not going to be a comedian. He didn't want me to be an orthodontist or a comedian. Or he didn't care. It was just whatever you do, just do it.
He just wanted you to get a job.
Just get a job. Yeah. Just go leave and get a job.
That was that generation too.
We never talked about future or dreams or my muse or I've got to dance. You know, there's nothing. It was just, I never talked to my dad about anything. So I didn't have any inner family thing. My friends were pretty blue collar, kind of rough and tumble, play sports, swing a hammer, drink some beers on Friday, get into a car accident on Saturday while you're drunk, you know, just like dudes. And so they didn't know about comedy or Groundlings or any of that. And then I guess the third tier would be your school, your counselor, teachers, people around you, you know, the professional grade who would say, hey, your school counselor who'd go, hey, I've heard you. You should take drama class or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any of that either. They were just sort of parole officers. You know, they just sort of watch you. I didn't really have any of that.
So you signed up for a class and you're going through, and you eventually got to where you were doing shows.
No, I signed up for a class and then I signed up for another class, and then I took a few free classes before waiting for the next class. I really just kept signing up for classes, and eventually when it got to the very end and the time they would decide whether you could do shows or not, they said, no, hit the bricks. Yeah.
So when you start off, and that must have felt like a punch in the stomach. You kind of feel like you're a failure at that time?
It was a very low point in my life because I had, at that point, it probably been about 4 years all in for the Groundlings and classes and community. And it was always with the goal to make the team, so to speak. And again, you know, 4 years now doesn't seem like so much, but from age 22 to 26 or 23 to 27, that's a good chunk of your adult life.
Oh, yeah, that's when you're supposed to be kind of like getting your shit together to be able to do what you want to do. But I bet you one thing, you probably did a lot of comedy writing when you were at the Groundlings, right? You're writing skits all the time, coming up with ideas, bouncing around, which may have led you to radio.
It depended on what class you took. Some were just like basic, straight improv, group improv. And then later on, they had like writer's lab and advanced class. And yeah, so you would do the basics of improv. And then at some point, you would get into writing.
Looking back, do you think that being in the Groundlings actually was a help to you? What were the lessons you learned from that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, it'd be like saying you went to chef school for 4 years, but you never did get a job at that restaurant. Do you feel like you're a better cook? And the answer is, yeah, I learned how to cook. Yeah, I learned a lot. I learned a lot. I took it with me.
What propelled you to get into radio, into keeping this thing on? Was it meeting Jimmy Kimmel? Was it?
No, I didn't meet Jimmy for a number of years after that. I kind of went home with my tail between my legs from the Groundlings. The Groundlings, their take was you can sign up for another advanced class in a year because they had a waiting list. You know, take it again, try it again. No guarantees you're getting in this time. I remember at the time thinking, you know, it's going to be 18 months or 2 years from now, and it's going to be a coin toss to see if I get in again. I just don't think I got that kind of commitment or time or money or anything. So I just went home and I was done with the Groundlings, and I had no place to go to do comedy, or I didn't have any group or anything. I wasn't a part of anything. And I went home, and my girlfriend at the time I was living with in a little single apartment in Hollywood had looked through like the drama log or one of those old papers, you know, and found in the back that there was a new improv troupe that was forming and they were looking for members. And if you wanted to try this new improv troupe, you could do it. So she like gave me the address and I went down there, and it ended up being the Acme Theater, which is still around today. But at the time it was called like the Two Roads Theater or something. It was like in Toluca Lake or whatever. So I just showed up with like seven or eight other people that were basically Groundling rejects, mostly.
Yeah.
Those people have been cut from the Groundlings like me. And, you know,
they were the cool kids.
Yeah. I remember thinking, well, this isn't much, but they can't really kick me out because I'll be the founding member. I'll be grandfathered in.
What were you doing to support yourself through all this? You were just having a job after job or what? You were still in carpentry?
Yeah, I was always a carpenter. I realized early I needed a pickup truck. I needed tools. You know, I needed a bed box and a lumber rack. Like my relationship with work and carpentry was very pragmatic. It was, you don't know anybody who has a car dealership, or your dad doesn't have, you know, he's not an attorney and you can't go work at his law office or anything. I knew I had no ins and no connections and no anything. Mm-hmm. And also I wasn't really cut out because I wasn't educated enough to like get a job, you know, where I was someone's personal assistant, or I couldn't type, you know, I couldn't spell. I knew that I needed to keep this job as a carpenter. I knew I needed to get better as a carpenter. I knew if I didn't want to do labor, I had to learn how to do finish work and other disciplines of carpentry. So I always worked full-time as a carpenter.
Hey, Dennis Quaid here. You may know that I'm a musician and a huge music fan, and I want to tell you about a new podcast that I discovered. I've been listening to Eric Krasno Plus One, a podcast hosted by Grammy Award-winning guitarist and producer Eric Krasno. I love the interviews. They go deep with musicians, and you hear stories of life in the studio, life on the road. Those are really good, or bad, depending on which side of the story you're on. You got stories with bandmates and all the other shenanigans that go on behind the scenes. On Plus One, Eric has candid conversations with legendary musicians, many who are also his friends. And at the end of each episode, Eric plays a favorite track from his guest. So it's great for discovering new music, too. On Plus One, Eric has candid conversations with legendary musicians, many who are also his friends. And at the end of each episode, Eric plays a favorite track from his guest. So it's great for discovering new music, too. Eric's talked to people like Dave Matthews, Marcus King, Chris Robinson, and upcoming episodes feature conversations with John Mayer, Questlove, Derek Trucks, Phil Lesh, and so many more. So take a listen to Eric Krasno Plus One. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Hi, Dennis Quaid here. Hey, we all have tough days and things that interfere with our happiness or achieving our goals. If you are looking to better yourself, then you should look into BetterHelp. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. BetterHelp evaluates what you need and connects you to your very own licensed professional therapist. You'll be connected in less than one day, and you can send messages to your counselor anytime, day or night. This is not self-help, but it is professional counseling from the comfort of your own home. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you could schedule your own weekly video or phone sessions. Confidential, convenient, professional, and affordable. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/Quaid. Join over 800,000 people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Quaid. Well, yeah, so you had a skill to fall back on.
Well, I wasn't falling back on it. I was smack dab in the middle of it.
Well, you had fallen back.
I was just falling back in general. But yeah, I never, it's funny, once I stopped doing carpentry, I never fell back on it. But I had a skill and my other options were, you know, work at Wendy's or McDonald's for $6 an hour. And I was making $13 an hour as a carpenter. So my plan was to keep going with that.
Well, Harrison Ford had the same thing, didn't he? He was like doing a lot of carpentry work. In fact, I think that's when they were casting Star Wars. He was doing some carpentry work there in the offices and they just asked him to come over and read.
Yeah. I'd always heard that story. I've never met him. I always felt like, you know, because of what I know, I can tell if a guy's a real carpenter or not. And I always had this fantasy about hanging out, meeting Harrison Ford and asking him, you know, what number insulation goes in 2x4s versus a 2x6 wall? R13, R16, what's the layout when you're framing? Tell me what the difference between a trimmer and a king stud is. What's the difference between 8-penny, 16-penny ring shanks and duplex nails? Get the lingo going. So yeah, I always work full time. I work full time as a carpenter, which was kind of tough because the comedy world that I was fantasizing about was sort of late night coffee shops, cigarettes, and writing jokes. And the carpentry world was up at 6, you know, drive to Canoga Park, rolled out and working by 7, and just kind of dealing with the dust and the heat, you know.
Yeah, which one sounds better?
Right.
Well, what was the magic moment, though, for you? Did you have a magic moment, or did at the time and realize it, or did you look back and go, hey, that was a magic moment?
I had been trucking around doing my carpentry, taking my classes, doing open mics, stand-up, doing anything I could do, taking anything anyone would give me, you know, play some New Year's Eve party for $50 and do 10 minutes of stand-up or something. Like, I would just take anything, do anything. It wasn't going anywhere. It just wasn't going anywhere. I wasn't making any money. I taught comedy traffic school. I thought, well, I could get paid to tell some jokes if I do comedy traffic school. And I was,
and you had a captive audience, right?
Captive, angry audience.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, you'd make $85 or $90 for a Saturday, you know, 8 hours. And in my world, it was kind of like I was getting paid to do stand-up, you know, in a weird way. It was like my first professional gig. I said to myself, you know, by the time you're 30, if this thing is not working out, you're going to have to figure something else out. Like, because carpentry was hard work. You didn't get paid for days you weren't there. If it rained and the job site was muddy and you didn't work, you didn't get paid. No, I never had health benefits. I never had medical, dental insurance. I didn't have anything. And I was like, I'll give you till 30 to get a job doing something creative. It doesn't need to be on TV or behind a microphone. It could be just be contributing to someone who's on TV or behind a microphone or producer.
Yeah.
Writing funny greeting cards. That I would accept that. Anything but swinging a hammer. And 30 was coming up, and I didn't appear to be really any closer to my goal. I was just going to turn 30. I'd taken a bunch of classes. I'd done Acme Theater. I'd done a bunch of open mics. I had nothing to show for it. I wasn't getting paid. I didn't have any connections. And it didn't seem like it was working out. But one day, when I was driving my truck over the hill to deliver an entertainment unit I built for a customer, at that point, I had clients, and I would build them. And I was doing a lot of finish work, and so I'd build them an entertainment unit or a chest of drawers. I'd build people beds, you know. I'd be like custom. I had a handful of clients that had a little money, and I sort of built them custom stuff. And I heard about a box. I was listening to K-Rock out in Los Angeles, and I heard the Kevin and Bean show, and I heard Jimmy the Sports Guy, who's Jimmy Kimmel, and I heard him talking about a boxing match. And I was also teaching boxing as well. I built a gym called Bodies in Motion, and I taught classes there. And they needed boxing coaches and equipment, and they needed everything because this fight was on. And a light went off in my head. I was like, I got to get in on this. I thought, I want to see the inside of a radio station. I didn't know who Jimmy was. I didn't know the guy he was fighting. I didn't know anything. I just kept calling and nobody would answer the phone. I'd leave a message. Nobody would call back. I didn't have a cell phone. You know, I had to get to the client's house and run in and ask if I could use the phone, you know, bolted to the wall in the kitchen. And
it's like to be the 10th caller or something.
Yeah. Well, they kept saying, we need trainers. We need trainers.
Right.
You know, we need trainers. I was like, I'm a trainer. I'm a trainer. I'm a trainer. And no one ever called back. Eventually, I literally just went to the radio station one morning. And I went there early because I used to teach a 7 a.m. class in Pasadena. And I couldn't get in because the building was locked. And then I found out they opened the building at 7. It was like a commercial building. And I said, okay, I'll come back the next day at 7 because I had to go teach my class, you know. So I went and taught my class. And then the next day, I got a guy to cover for me for like the first half of my class. I went back to the building at 7 and I got in the building and I went up the elevator to where K-Rock was on the 9th floor in Burbank. But K-Rock was locked. Their business hours start at 9 a.m. So I found myself just standing in the lobby, standing by the elevators on the 9th floor. I didn't know what to do. K-Rock was locked.
Yeah, because if you go downstairs, you may not get back up.
If I get back, but there was nothing back. There's nothing where I was either. I couldn't get into K-Rock. I knew they were doing the morning show in the building, but the suite was locked. Their floor was locked up. So I was just standing there by the elevators, kind of trying to figure out what to do, how I could knock on the door, how it would work. And some guy was walked in, you know, with like a key card. He was going in the back door. He was dropping off stuff. He worked there or something. Just going in. I just said, hey, I'm a boxing coach. I'm here to teach some, you know, Jimmy or Michael, the maintenance man. That's the guy he was fighting. I said, I'm here. I'm a boxing coach. I'm waiting by the elevators. When you go in, could you tell those guys you're just a boxing coach standing by the elevators and I'll be waiting here? And I stood there for like 20 minutes or something. At some point, Jimmy came out, just came down the hall. He just walked down the hall, just looking at me. And he said, are you the boxing coach? I said, yeah, I'm the boxing coach. He said, okay. I said, do you want me to train you to box? He said, yeah. Okay. I said, okay, when do you want to start? And he said, I don't know, today? And I said, okay, we'll start today. And I said, what time? He said, noon. Where are you at? I said, we're in Pasadena. That's where my gym is. He said, okay, I'll see you there at noon. I said, okay, I'll just be standing in the parking structure, just kind of waiting for you to pull in. You know, I said, okay. And that was it.
So you trained Jimmy for, what, a couple of weeks? And
yeah, it was probably...
Yeah, did you get on air with him when the bout came up?
Yeah, it was probably, as I recall, it was probably like 2.5 weeks. It was like a little more than 2 weeks, maybe 17 days or something like that. Mm. And yeah, once or twice maybe they said, let's check in with the trainers and see how the progress is going, you know, in kind of morning zoo fashion.
Right.
And so I was trying to be funny, you know,
right.
And I was being funny. But it was also kind of weird because I didn't want to present myself like a comedian. I want to present myself like a boxing coach because I didn't want to make people think I was just trying to get in my foot in the door so I could do comedy.
But that was your break, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you actually got on the air and that was the start of something right there. After that... Did you become like you go from this boxing match? So how'd you get back on the air after that?
You know, by the time I had worked with Jimmy for 2 weeks plus, we found ourselves just talking comedy so much. You know, we'd do a little bit of boxing and then we'd sit around and talk comedy for 2 hours and drink a Snapple. You know, they had a little cafe upstairs above the gym, and the gym was kind of down in the basement in Old Town Pasadena. And, you know, we'd train for like half an hour or something, and then I'd say, yeah, let's go upstairs and get a Snapple. And, you know, he wanted to stop training too. So we'd go upstairs and get a Snapple, and then we'd just sit there talking for like 2 hours about comedy and what we wanted to do and blah, blah, blah. And I had this old VHS tape that I made on some like Eagle Rock community TV station or something about answering home improvement questions or something. One, it's just a nothing burger, but I gave it to him and he saw it and he was convinced that I was funny and talented. He even though I was his boxing coach. So when we're done with the boxing match, you know, now he didn't have a lot of sway over at the station. He was pretty new. And no one was listening to him. And he kind of knew it. But I said, well, what do we do? Because we're kind of at the end of our trail here. Now, we either part ways and I never get on the radio, or we somehow get me on the radio. But but I'm your boxing coach, and the bout's over. So how do we do this, you know? And he said to me, what do you do? What is it that you do? What is your strength? What do you want to do? What are you good at? And I said, what I do is I sit and I crack wise. I improvise. I work off the cuff. I sit in, you know, between Kevin and Bean, and I make them funnier. And he said, well, we don't need that. You're not coming into the studio and cracking wise. You're the boxing coach. You know, you're not just gonna be on the air, you know, as the third guy. Kevin and Bean, that's their job. You don't do that. I said, well, that's what I do. He said, well, if you want to get on the radio, you have to come up with a character. And I said, I don't really do characters. I do what I said I did. And he said, well, you want to get on, then you come up with a character because that's the way you're going to get on. And I said, okay. And he said, you know, here's the number to call in on Monday. This is probably like on a Friday. Here's the number to call in on a Monday. And I'm not going to tell them who you are. I'm not going to tell them that you're the boxing coach because that'll taint you. They'll think of you as the boxing coach. I'm just going to tell them I got a guy. He's funny. He's going to call in on Monday. And he said, look, they're going to hear it. They're probably not going to like it. And that'll probably be the last time you could call in. But if they like it, you can then call in the next week. You know, and I said, okay, thanks. And then I just spent the whole weekend trying to come up with a character, which I wasn't good at. But I had enough groundling training and enough improv training to know how to develop a character.
Yeah, so they came up with a shop teacher, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that a real person that was, you know, like from your past?
You know,
yeah, like in high school, the shop teacher.
It was kind of a composite. The guy, my shop teachers in junior high were all sort of gnarled, kind of rough asses, you know, Vietnam.
Yeah, they were usually the guys that, you know, had the board that you get pops with if you were out of line or something. They would, either the gym coaches or the shop teacher who would, you know, deal out the corporal punishment.
They seem to hate kids, which I always felt funny. And they had kind of a through line, which is they didn't
had
like
a very short fuse. Too.
Short fuse, didn't like their kids, and kind of looked at it as the shop was their shop, and they were being inconvenienced by kids showing up at their shop. They never really thought that that's the school shop, and they're there to teach kids. But
yeah,
they were all angry, scary, you know, big forearm, salt and pepper in the hair kind of guys. And I remember to this day, like Mr. Gage, the metal shop teacher, he was an asshole. Mr. Saponzi, you know, Mr. Martin. Like, I hated all these guys. And so did everyone. They were angry guys. And so I thought, those guys, that guy would be a good character. And I know that world. I know carpentry. I know woodworking really well. And there's a guy I played Pop Warner football with in Sun Valley Falcons named Eric Burcham. And I liked his name because it had the word birch in it, like wood, you know. So I came up with Mr. Burcham. And Mr. Burcham taught remedial wood at Louis Pasteur Middle School in Monrovia, which, of course...
Remedial wood.
Remedial. And, of course, none of it existed, but I just showed up as that guy, and that's who I was.
You developed that character, and I think kind of out of that character came Adam Carolla a bit. It seems to me that all the driving around in between jobs, in between looking for jobs as a carpenter in your truck, you were like the regular guy trying to make a living out there in the real world, having real thoughts about all these big ideas that, you know, the politicians and the government all come up with. You're a regular guy. My memory of you is when I first heard you on the radio. You developed yourself during a time here in California. You seemed to be kind of a conservative voice that had its roots in the working man, which is usually sort of a union democratic base. And but it was just kind of a no nonsense thing. It really reminded me of my dad and his politics, because it wasn't about big ideas. It was about just a day to day experience in life.
Yeah, you know, I was never in a union. I always wanted to be in one because I saw how sort of synthetic it was. I mean, not, you know, here's what I kind of learned. I learned that if you just worked like I did, you just worked, you got $15 an hour. But if you could get into a union, you could get $25 an hour plus golden time, plus overtime, plus, you know, benefits, plus, you know, holidays, plus everything. And of course I wanted that. I'd get paid holidays and medical and dental and stuff. I could never find my way to that. At some point I got a job doing earthquake rehab work for the city, and I went from making $13 an hour to making like $19 an hour just because I was working for the city. But I also kind of realized that they got stuff wrong. Like, each job could have like one laborer and five carpenters on it when we were doing earthquake rehab work. And for some reason, the carpenters got $18 an hour and the laborers got $19.50 an hour. So in some weird world, the laborers got paid more. And so they made me the laborer because I was the best carpenter. So we're living in kind of backwards world. It's like as the best. So at the time, a carpenter, at the time I was getting $13-14 an hour as a carpenter, and a laborer would get $7-8 an hour. I mean, they get paid about half of what the carpenters got paid. In the city world, they got paid more. And I started to kind of look at that, and it had a lot of bureaucracy around it. Like you needed to have a black person, you need to have a woman, you need to have, like, it was a lot of rules, you know, and a lot of the, you know, people, some of the people they hired weren't carpenters, but they still needed a person to check the box. So they needed a black person, even if he wasn't a carpenter, but they needed to fill it. The EEOC needed blah, blah, blah. And I started to kind of realize these rules are costing the taxpayers money and they're not getting this job finished any faster. And I don't even think they're really helping the woman who's on the job site who's not a carpenter. She's getting paid temporarily, but I don't know what the big picture is for her. And frankly, it's a little dangerous for her because she doesn't really know how to handle herself. So I started like seeing the lay of the land at that point. And it was kind of at that point where I just got this sort of brass tacks kind of basic position, which serves me practically, but politically, it's the way I think too. It's like
there's not a lot of people. I don't feel like there's a lot of people, especially here in LA, on the radio from your background with your experience, and you seem to be the voice for all those people who are the working people who are driving around in between jobs and listening to talk radio in town.
Yeah, I didn't go to college, so I don't have ideologies, you know. It's kind of an interesting time we're in, which is people think I have an ideology. I'm not religious, and I didn't go to college. My ideology, I say to people all the time, here's my ideology. If I'm a personal trainer and my ideology is diet and exercise, that's it.
Yeah.
Just work, raise your kids, pay your bills, feed your kids. I don't know. Yeah. I don't think that's an ideology. That's just life.
Well, having a job, feeding your kids and everything is not an ideology nor necessarily being part of any political party either.
Well, it's becoming politicized, which is interesting to me.
It has over the past 20, 30 years. It's come to that. And it's reflected in every part of life these days.
Yeah,
but you've always been the kind of guy that, you know, you've said yes to everything. As far as getting a job, you believe in working, and you've worked yourself up. From there, you go to television, you do the man show, you got Dr. Drew. What was that you felt about dispensing advice? Did you feel like you were at all qualified for that?
I always had a lot of ideas and notions and thoughts, and I kind of thought of myself as pretty pragmatic. I always had an interest in psychology, even though my life wouldn't have suggested it at the time. I did like the way that the human mind worked, and I was always attracted to that. And what motivated people and how to motivate people, and I was always something that was very interesting to me. And I've never really made a separation between a love of psychology and a love of comedy. Comedy is really just mastering psychology and putting a little twist at the end. But it's really, there's a lot of psychology in comedy. And so for me, I love the idea of somebody giving me a microphone for 2 hours a night and bouncing those ideas off America. I was in love with that job.
Well, you always seem to be willing to try anything from that. And, you know, you go on into television and then you get, and by the way, I just saw Winning the other night, Paul Newman, about Paul Newman in racing. And
Gosh, I can't believe what a well-done movie that was.
Oh, thanks. Really
incredible. You know, and I think because you've been unafraid to try anything has made you what you are, really. You're an author. And what's the book that you got coming up?
It's I have
I'm
your emotional support animal navigating our all woke, no joke universe or society or something. Navigating our all woke, no joke, Gary Sputnik culture. Yeah, that's out June 16th, but it always helps to pre-order the books because it gets you into more outlets. So pre-order it. You just go to Amazon, get the audiobook or get the hardback. It'll be my fifth book. And it's, I think, amongst my most poignant and funniest. It's just no holds barred. I mean, I'm just, every opinion that's in my head is on that book, on the page.
I think you ought to write a book about the lockdown that's going on now. I feel that percolating with you.
Believe it or not, there is some of that in there because we're finishing the book as this thing was going down. So there is the last chapter is on the virus. And I'm glad you saw Winning. I like making docs a lot. There's also a bunch of docs on Netflix that we've done, if you want to see those as well, racing docs.
Well, Adam, I feel like your life and just who you are deserves several more shows, actually, as the Renaissance goes on here. And hey, I can't tell you what an inspiration you are to me, actually, because I'm new to this podcast thing myself. And I've always lived with a philosophy that I'll try anything twice.
Well, this is taking a long time to come around, but when I've always told you on my podcast, but I'll say it on your podcast now, of course, when the movie Breaking Away was in the theaters in 1979, 1980, I saw that and I was so inspired. And I didn't have one foot in acting or show business or anything. I was playing football in high school. You know, I was just a jock, but I was so inspired by Breaking Away. And I just thought it was so, it just struck a chord in me. And I'm not sure.
Well, it was about kids like you, actually.
Right. It really
was. Who had grown up like townies, who, you know, were just expected not to really get any place. And they were living in a college town and all they really, their future was maybe getting a job as a stone cutter.
I was basically 2.5 years away from being a cutter, except for there was no quarry or mill in my town. I was just going to be out. And I just struck a chord. And I always just thought, if I ever made a movie, that would be my template for a movie. And about 10 years ago, I made a movie called The Hammer, which is a boxing movie. And it's really just breaking away for boxing, if you look at that movie.
That's the next one I got to see. Oh, you just have so much stuff. It's hard to go through your body of work, man.
Well, if you like a sports movie, you should definitely watch The Hammer because that is. And you, of all people, should watch it because it's really. I had Breaking Away in my head when I was writing and making that film, all through the whole film.
Well, maybe you and I should do a boxing match because, you know, I boxed for 20 years myself.
Oh, no, I'm too scared.
So am I. Well,
I think I checked. I honestly think I remember I went to like Rotten Tomatoes. Gary, you can do this. I went to Rotten Tomatoes and I thought, I wonder.
It's 80%. It's great.
I said, what's the score and what's the people score? And then I went, what's the Breaking Away score and the Breaking Away people score? And I think they had the same score, which means Rotten Tomatoes has no idea what they're doing. But
they didn't have Rotten Tomatoes when it came out, but I guess they score it anyway.
Breaking Away is 94 with the critics, which is unbelievable, and 88 with the people. And The Hammer is 80 with the critics and 90 with the people. So the The edge goes to Breaking Away, but still, pretty close.
I don't know. Sounds like a rematch to me.
Well, watch it and tell me what you think.
All right, pal. Hey, man, it's been great talking to you.
keep going. And let's get back together here on your show or on the Denaissance anytime.
My my door's always open, Dennis.
Same here, man.
Thank you.
You have a great one.
You too.
See you. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Denaissance. Please make sure to rate, review, and of course subscribe so you can get new episodes delivered straight to your podcast player. Hey, and make sure to tune back in next week. Ooh, la, la.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.